When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Tyler, how you doing?
Good. Hey. I'm in. I can hear you.
All right. I can hear you. This is good. So welcome to the tent. So
thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. This is everybody. This is Tyler Wells. Tyler is known on Instagram and probably most of the forums as Inland Reef. And this is kind of fun for me. It's Tyler, as you know, my background, you know, is reefing. Before I really got into the botanical thing and kind of jumped to that, I was a reefer, hardcore reefer, and still am. And as I'm getting back into my new reef tank, it's kind of fun to talk to some people that are doing it and been doing it for a while. And Tyler and I have a common interest in mangroves, which is something that a lot of our community is into. And Tyler, it's really going to be fun to talk to you today. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it should be a blast. Thanks so much.
Yeah, so I, you know, without getting too cliche, if you can give me like the 2 minute origin story of you and the hobby, like what's your jam? I mean, I know you've been a reefer for a while, but how'd you start?
Ooh, okay. So let's see. I mean, quick start. I of course started in the freshwater side as most people do. My parents got me a betta fish called Bluey. You could probably guess the color.
I'm going to say it wasn't red.
No, it wasn't red. And so my dad had fish tanks, and you know, I grew up fishing a lot from the Midwest area of the United States. And so did a lot of fishing and just loved that aspect about it. So I started keeping fish tanks myself. Ultimately went off to college, got my degree in zoology, actually specializing in ornithology. So study of birds, cool. But I did a lot of work with, fisheries and things like that. So kind of re-sparked my interest in keeping aquariums again. And then when I graduated from college, I thought, you know, hey, I now have a career. I have the funds. Let's really dive into this saltwater side and started the whole aspect of reef keeping. Picked up a small all-in-one tank, sort of caught the bug. And then from there, I just started evolving and learning about mangroves and macroalgae, and then just took off from there. So that's kind of my little cool spiel.
I like it. Now, you know, what's interesting too with your background in zoology, I find it interesting because, as you know, I'm kind of obsessed with ecology in general and just like how natural systems come together and habitats and so forth. So it's kind of cool that you have that background, and I would imagine studying birds and later on fishes, it probably taught you to look at the entire ecosystem a little differently. I would imagine that kind of was one of your entrees into reef keeping, is that you kind of took a different approach.
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, I took a lot of ecology courses, and I've worked for a lot of like forest park districts, the National Park Service. So I've done a lot of things that involve a lot of ecology and looking at a holistic sort of ecosystem and what's beneficial, what's invasive, what's not supposed to be there. How do we adapt, change, or live with what's currently there? So definitely has sort of curbed my my thoughts and sort of actions towards what I do with my reef keeping or just aquarium keeping in general.
Right. It's amazing how it does it. Now, mangroves, which is something we share both a mutual love of, and you've actually given me some tips on mangroves, and they've been helpful. We're going to talk a little bit about mangroves today. I want to talk about your aquarium that if you feature on Instagram quite a bit, and if anybody hasn't seen it, please do go check out Inland Reef on Instagram and check out Tyler's amazing aquariums. Are actually, you know, you've got a couple little setups there, right? But you've got that one in particular, the 42 gallon tank, that's pretty well known to a lot of people on Instagram and in forums like Reef to Reef, where you were the tank of the month. I think, was it last May?
Yeah, it's like past May.
Yeah, and that's a pretty big honor. For those of you that aren't familiar with the reef keeping world. That's a big deal. There's a lot of talented reefers out there, and it's not just one of those like, hey, you know, here's a nice tank. It's kind of unique. And what's really unique about this is your tank is definitely not the flavor of the month in terms of reef keeping or saltwater aquariums for that matter.
No, it's not.
Yeah, you're doing an entire ecosystem. You're doing things that are currently, I don't want to say out of favor, but not super popular in the reef keeping side of the hobby. Deep sand beds, mangroves, diverse ecology. That's so cool. Now you did this, what, because you like it, right? That's your thing. Is it like you're into the mangroves and the systems, or is it like you just wanted to do something different? Or what kind of was the impetus to setting up a mangrove thing?
So I think I was, I mean, I live in a landlocked state. I am the farthest away from an ocean that you can possibly be.
Right.
So my thought was, you know, I love snorkeling. I love being like, you know, just being able to go around and do tide pooling and stuff like that. So for me, my thoughts of a saltwater tank is what I see when I walk out on the beach and be able to go swim around and explore there. So
right.
I tried to take essentially a chunk of the ocean and just bring it into my apartment here. Mm-hmm. And also, I really like mangroves. I mean, they're just so cool. I mean,
they are the
ability to be fresh, brackish, and full saltwater is just an incredible adaptation for a plant to be able to do that. So
it really is. And the thing I love about your tank, particularly your mangrove tank, and we'll talk about a lot of things, but that mangrove tank is that it's not a huge aquarium. It's 42 gallons, right? It's like 40 inches long or something like that. 39 inches long.
Yeah, 39 inches long, 16 tall, 16 wide. It's about 42 gallons or so. I can't remember what the liters are, but it's a basic tank. I think it looks bigger on camera, but it's not as big as people think.
Yeah, and what's nice about that size tank, it's very achievable for a lot of hobbyists that really are into it. We get questions every day about mangroves. People are really into them. And I think what's so cool is you've been doing it for a while, and you haven't been just doing the mangrove. You've been doing other organisms that live in the mangroves. Like you've been doing what, soft corals, microalgaes, gorgonians, stuff like that. What is your favorite sort of, I don't know, companion animal to the mangroves?
Oh, that is a
tough one, right?
Really hard thing. Well, it depends on which ecosystem you're trying to, I guess, go after. So I have two 42 gallons. They're actually the same style, same tank, same everything. One mm-hmm. has a sump, one doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And the one that you see the massive mangroves on, it originally started off as like a Caribbean style. So mm-hmm. I would say the best pairing for that one would be the Gorgonians, because I think there's just something cool about, if you're ever in the Caribbean, you have the mangroves lining, you know, the Caribbean coast, and then you just have seas of Gorgonians. Now, my other one, I'm sort of trying to emulate more of like Indonesia, mm-hmm. like that Indo-Pacific area.
Yeah.
And for me, my like holy grail of, you know, if you want to even call holy grail of things, very much a reefer term.
Absolutely a reefer term.
I have three yellow toadstools. Now, I'm not sure if they're like a Fiji. I'm not exactly sure where they're from. They came in on a shipment from Jakarta, Indonesia. So for me, I was like, this is perfect. I've always wanted a yellow toadstool.
Oh, yeah.
They were super common back in the day.
That used to be the Sarcophyton. I think it was Elegans, or it may have been a different species.
Sarcophyton Elegans.
But that was back in the early 2000s. We're sounding like a bunch of old guys. But back in the early 2000s, that was like the most common coral. And they were bright, bright banana yellow. Mm-hmm. And boy, they're hard to come by now. And when you get them now, they're really expensive, and they're not all that. They're like mustardy, and that's so you got those. And yep. How are they holding up for you color wise? Are you keeping them
mustardy?
Yeah.
So
there you go.
It depends because my apartment has massive windows. They're like mm-hmm. 10 or 12 foot tall windows. It's the great thing about living in a loft apartment.
Oh, and yeah.
One of my favorite times of day is when the sun rises. I get that northeast sort of early light. And when that light hits those toadstools, those sarcophytons, man, you can see that
pop.
True yellow. But when underneath like the actual lighting that I have, it turns into that sort of mustardy yellow. So there's a period of time where I just see it.
It's hard because I remember talking many times, Jake Adams and I were big toadstool mushrooms. Why am I going crazy? Toadstool corals, whatever you call them. And now I forgot what I call them. Toadstool. I just call them yellow leathers. But sure. We were big fans of those. And I remember he was saying, I can never get the things to stay yellow. And I'm like, I can't either. And we were like thinking, well, is it something in the collection process? Is it something the way we light things nowadays? Is it the sourcing? Is the ocean water different now? You know, I wonder what it – never sort of figured that out, unfortunately. But
there was a weird study, actually. Mark Vanderwall, he, you know, the co-host of Reef Therapy, previously with Jake Adams. Right. And so he was doing some studies that he was reading and some scientific articles that it could potentially be our lighting, that our lighting is more tuned in a sense towards – like that bluer side of things.
Yeah.
Whereas to really contrast and bring out that yellowness, you almost have to turn the greens up a little bit. So I've been slowly experimenting with my Kessels to slowly essentially increase that green spectrum. Hopefully we'll see. I mean, I have nothing of note yet. It's going to definitely be more of a long-term process. But I'm hoping maybe at the year mark, maybe I'll see, I guess, visually a little bit more yellow, hard to sort of document that.
that'll be interesting. Now, what light you're using, Kessel, which one are you using? The
AP and INX.
Yep. Okay, that's a great light. That's a really great light. You tend to run a little more daylight spectrum, would you say, than most people do?
I'm running that light as white as you possibly can or more full spectrum as you possibly can get. So it's, I would say it's sitting near the 12,000 Kelvin,
which is funny that we call that white, because back in, I sound old, but back in the earlier days of reefing, like 12K was considered so blue. I mean, even 10K was like, oh, it's blue. But you look at it now compared to the typical reefer's aquarium, which is Windex blue. The thing is just white and yellow, and you're like, whoa. But you're right, coral colors are better too.
I used to run actually on the big mangrove tank. I used to run a Twin Star on it. So that was 6,300 Kelvin. I mean, that was very much daylight. Yep.
Right.
And so I had that light over my essential reef tank for the better part of two and a half years. I mean,
probably got good color. Yeah.
Grew coral like crazy, grew macroalgae like crazy, grew my mangroves like crazy. I mean,
I love it. I have a Twin Star over my my blackwater tank right now. It's like, and I just have it kind of turned down because it's more for aesthetics than anything else. It's a great little light. I mean, it can grow a lot of stuff. And we're seeing a sort of a resurgence that you've been kind of leading in terms of more ecologically diverse saltwater aquariums. I don't want to necessarily say reef aquarium because that's kind of a catch-all.
Sure.
But you're running macroalgae, you're doing, Discosoma, you're doing Ricordia, all those kind of corals and things that go with that type of shallow, diverse shallow water ecosystem. Do you have, if you were telling somebody, if somebody said, how do I start a tank like yours? Is there one or two recommendations you could make? And I know that's like a bajillion recommendations you can make when somebody's starting a saltwater or reef tank. Is there one thing you could say like, hey, This is a direction you should go in?
That's a great question. Well, I would say personally, so before I even got into like keeping saltwater tanks while I was in college, didn't have the funds for it, didn't have the time for it. I spent a lot of time researching, reading, learning, understanding the concepts. Now, the nitrogen cycle, very similar in sense to the freshwater cycle. So you can kind of take a lot of maybe some of that preliminary knowledge you might have from the freshwater side, if you had done that, and sort of transitioned it to the saltwater side. But I think in the sense of sort of my thought is do as much research as you can and be able to sort of plan out what you're trying to accomplish. For me, of course, reef tanks or saltwater tanks, or really any tank in general, is always evolving, always changing. It's an ever-growing system. But I initially, before I set up any system, I always will draw out sort of what my end goal is. So kind of positioning things like where the mangroves are going to go, where rocks will be, maybe where certain corals that I'm interested in growing. And of course, a lot of that, patterns of growth may come with time as you sort of progress in the hobby. But a lot of that information is out there. I mean, you do have forums, and I'm very cautious of, like, say, projecting someone or pushing someone to a forum.
Right.
Because sometimes information can be both good and bad, or just be overwhelming.
Exactly.
I think the one thing I would say, if I was starting over brand new from scratch, didn't really have much knowledge, I would go and find someone who has a tank or a system or a setup that I thoroughly enjoy and was like, you know what, if that was going to be what I could create, I would want it to emulate that. And I would go and start a conversation, create, you know, a good friendship or a partnership or something with this individual, and sort of have, I guess, maybe a mentorship to grow into that and learn how they are successful, right? There's 1,000 ways to be successful in not only a freshwater tank, but also a saltwater tank. And I think it's setting your expectations of what you want out of it, and then being able to find someone who has either achieved or maybe has been successful in what you're trying to get out of it and learn from them. I think that would be my one number
fantastic
one
advice.
Yeah. And then from there, I mean, a lot of the information about the animals is relatively out there. I mean, of course, obscure ones, if you start to get into some, you know, not as common, maybe say corals or invertebrates or fish, that information might not be there, but you can also use things like Google Scholar. There might
be
some articles, scientific articles that, you know, scientists may have written about it, but a majority of, like, the bread and butter fish, coral, things like that, you can probably get your information from the individual at the local fish store or even multiple reputable stores, I would say, online. I mean, I've used your former company a couple times to look up quite a few things to sort of learn about maybe where that region is from, sort of its care requirements and things like that.
Well, I think that's important. And I like that you recommended, as you know, I'm a big fan of, like, don't just stick with the fish, the aquarium world, social media for your information. There's plenty of good information out there. There's a lot of talented people. But when you mentioned Google Scholar, that's, like, one of my favorite resources. I found so many ideas in both reef keeping and in the freshwater stuff that I've been able to utilize to create really interesting aquariums, or, you know, play a hunch here or there. I think we tend as hobbyists to aggregate to, like, where the, you know, where the other hobbyists are. And sometimes people have been afraid to kind of go out into the deep end of the pool and look at the scholarly research and figure out how to interpret that. And it's refreshing that you're mentioning that as a recommendation for people to do, because I can't recommend that enough. That's some awesome advice.
Sure. And I think, really, to be honest, a goal of mine was always to sort of, of course, I didn't have a lot of money, and I wanted to embark on, you know, a hobby that, of course, spends extra money that I probably didn't have.
Like, it's going out of style. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And so my thought was, what are ways in which I can convert from, say, the freshwater side to the saltwater side with minimal amount of expense added, minus, like, livestock and things like that, but just equipment wise. And so that was kind of where I started my experiment, by using the Twin Star. And my main system, actually, the one with the big mangroves, is completely sumpless. It's, in a sense, you would say filterless, right?
Yes.
Now I guess it does have a hang on back filter there, but that's literally only to run carbon. It's my poor man's carbon reactor.
But you know, but that's what's so cool, is, like, that when you really think about it, even in an average reef tank, there, other than the ancillary support equipment we use, protein skimmers, the maybe reactors, dosers, or whatever, it's basically just a sump, a box of water at the beneath it, and that circulates the water, adds to the water volume, whatever. But a system like yours, it takes it in terms of somebody coming over from freshwater to play with brackish, or in this case saltwater, it's a great step, because it's ecologically diverse. It relies on substrate, and in this case plants and macroalgae and a whole host of life forms, which is something that is kind of familiar to most freshwater people. It actually seems to me like an aquarium like yours would be a great intro into the saltwater world.
Yeah, I would say so too. And the majority of the equipment that I'm using, you probably have laying around, whether it's an extra tank that you haven't set up a tank yet, or it might be a system you've already set up. Most likely, you have the necessary means. I mean, my little tiny 10-gallon bowl aquarium that has my purple reef lobster in it is being run by a canister filter.
Yeah, I mean,
you can use, you know, interchangeably between a saltwater and a freshwater tank.
And that's what's so amazing. I think one of the great misnomers of saltwater or reef aquarium keeping is that it has to be expensive, filled with all this high-tech gear, when the reality is, if you're doing what you're doing, which is to try to cultivate an ecologically diverse, sort of balanced ecosystem, you don't need all the high-tech gadgets. You can use those to do some things, which I know you do. You have a few fancy gadgets, but you're creating an environment for your ecology first and then technology second, which is kind of my approach to freshwater, which is really kind of brings me for a full circle, because I'm going back into reef keeping a little differently for the first time in quite a few years, setting up a brand new reef tank. And I'm like looking at this and I'm going, I have so much tech on this tank, not a lot, but more than I've really ever had in the past. And I'm like, it almost sometimes seems like it's not as fun as just this sort of winging it, you know, like we do with the freshwater stuff where, you know, you create the ecosystem here. It's like, oh, try to keep this pest out. Don't have a deep sand bed. Don't do this. Don't do that. You know, all the things I used to do. And I'm like, I'm doing it a little differently right now. So it's kind of a fun foil to the freshwater stuff. But what you're painting a picture of is you can take that same theme and carry it into saltwater. And I love that. You don't have to do it the high tech way.
You don't. And that's the thing is, like, I have run these tanks successfully for the last 3 years. Yep. It's only recently that I've started traveling quite a bit for work. And so I've looked to a controller to allow me to sort of keep tabs on the tanks while I'm away for long durations of time. Mm-hmm. It allows me to not have to worry too much about, say, paying someone to come and monitor the tank when I can also just open my phone up and monitor it myself.
Right.
Is it necessary to run this system? Absolutely not.
No.
But it can be beneficial in situations. And going to, like, what you're saying, a lot of people are using that tech to sort of set up their tank, when in real honesty, I think you should really set up a tank and learn the biology and learn the aspects of running a reef tank prior to using that technology. Use 100%. The technology to help you, not sort of hinder you in the sense of setting up the system.
Absolutely, because I know plenty of guys, and you've heard me probably rail on this before, but I know plenty of guys that have spent five digits on their reef aquariums, and they're the crappiest aquariums I've ever seen. They just have every gadget known to man, but if you don't have the fundamentals down, like, you could buy a Ferrari if you can afford it, but if you can't drive, your Ford Mustang well, you're not going to be able to drive a Ferrari well, or that's probably a bad analogy, but you know what I mean? It's like, all the technology is not going to make up for your lack of understanding of how an ecosystem works and the skill. And I think what I love is that you're, again, saying, hey, we got to learn the technique and the art, because I think that's been kind of lost recently in the world of reef keeping. It's coming back, but I think so much emphasis was placed on grabbing the new technology and relying on technology and just getting to collecting corals as opposed to understanding what you're doing. And I think it's nice to see a system like yours that uses technology, but the idea is a concept and fostering the ecology first. I love that.
Yeah, and I have a rule. I have no frag racks. Absolutely no frag racks.
Don't ever want to see a frag. Yes, no frag. Yeah, I know you're not into that at all. Neither am I.
I do not like seeing. To me, that is the collectoritis of the reef keeping hobby that I think I wish that, you know, wouldn't be such a thing, but I get it. I get why people are enticed by it. I see the aspects. I've been to multiple, you know, hobbyist shows, and I see all the hype behind it. But to me, the display is a display. I wanted to represent what should be there. And so I would rather have a few corals that grow large and really fill in a space than have 500 corals that are fighting every 10 minutes that I have to deal with. And
I love that mindset, because it's funny. I think that's what led me but that's what kind of got me a little burnt on the reef scene for a while and back into the freshwater world, was that, you know, especially working in the commercial side of it, it was just so much emphasis on collecting stuff and gadgetry and trying to one up everybody with your expensive coral, and less emphasis was placed on creating an ecosystem or managing an aquarium. And it was so refreshing to go back into this botanical stuff and really practice what I grew up doing, which was running aquariums, not, you know, managing equipment. And I think that that's, it's nice to see aquariums like yours. I don't want to say having a moment, but actually getting the attention they deserve. You've been doing this a long time, and it's, there you are, Tyler. Are you there?
Hello.
Hey, Tyler. Hi, Tyler. Sorry about that.
No, no worries. The joy. What's happening?
You know, sometimes we have, this is, you're not the first guest I've had this happen to. It happens a lot. Unfortunately, this platform's great. It just doesn't always work well when you're doing collaborations. So maybe we'll have to migrate off this platform at some point, but let's try to stay with it as long as we can. Everybody, that there's the choppiness on this. So we're talking about mangroves. If someone wanted to start a mangrove tank, what would you recommend? Equipment, technique, approach, what mangrove would you use, et cetera?
Oh, that's a great question. Okay, cool. Yeah. So for me, I think when you're going to set up a mangrove tank, you almost have to think about the mangrove's care first and then everything else that's going to go in the tank second.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are trees. They do grow. And they will probably outgrow your tank at some point. So for me, when I look at what I should do first, I look at what's going to be in the substrate itself. Because that's where the roots will eventually go down into and, of course, acquire a lot of the nutrients that are necessary for the tree to grow healthy. I've used products like Two Little Fishies Refugite.
Mm-hmm.
I've used some of your product, the Mangle.
Mm-hmm.
I've used Miracle Mud or Mineral Mud. And a lot of times what I'll do is that'll be inside of like a acrylic box or like a small container, and then I'll cap it with sand, you know, whatever sort of aesthetically pleasing sand that you like. And the reason is that sort of keeps those nutrients inside the sediment area, right? It doesn't leach out as much into the water column. Then from there, when it comes to like picking a mangrove, the red mangroves are probably the most common and easiest to find. You can probably find them at any of your local fish stores. But for me, what I look for is actually a mangrove that has no leaves and no roots. And the reasoning behind that, especially when it comes into the saltwater side, red mangroves specifically use a pressure system to sort of excrete the salt from their trunks. I know there's a common misconception that goes around that they actually excrete the salt from their leaves. I have been growing my mangroves for many years, and I rarely spray the leaves at all. There's not salt creep. I actually have a black mangrove that I'm now starting to grow that does excrete salt from its leaves, and you can clearly see the salt crystals growing in the leaves. I do actually have to clean that one. So the reason I try to find one without roots, it allows me to position the mangrove so that way I can actually instigate the prop root growth to grow into that substrate layer that I've created.
That's important because that's something that drives me crazy to see people take the propagal and shove it into the sand. Can you talk a little bit more about that technique to get people to understand what you're talking about?
Well, and to go off of what you said, by shoving that propagule, especially in a saltwater tank, into the sand bed, you risk the aspect of actually breaking the roots.
Yep.
And by breaking the roots, you open up what I call like a faucet, right? If you close the faucet, nothing comes out. But if you break the roots and you open the faucet, anything and everything can come in and come out, right? And so essentially the water path just inundates the mangrove tree with so much salt that they cannot actually expel that salt out of their trunk or the tree itself. And they essentially get salt stress. And typically that's what I see, especially when people message me or send pictures and they're like, why the heck is my mangrove looking bad? 99% of the time, your roots are probably broken because you jammed it into the sand bed.
Right.
So what I do is I take a clear acrylic rod, and I will actually use some fishing line and I'll tie it to that clear rod where the base of the mangrove is actually elevated out of the sand bed. And I'll stick that clear acrylic rod into the substrate layer. And what that does is it sort of instigates the roots to grow down, right? Because now the mangrove itself is not stable. And in the wild, the reason why they put up these prop roots is so that they can stabilize themselves. You won't get the great canopy with leaves up top if you don't have a strong root structure below.
Right. And I think people are so caught up with, you know, they're enamored with the leaves and the branches, they forget that the real charm to me of a mangrove is those prop roots. And if you're not doing what you need to do to facilitate the growth of the prop roots, you're, first of all, as you mentioned, you're not going to have a healthy mangrove. And you're not going to see those roots, which is the whole game.
The best part.
That's it's like what you're preaching also involves patience, and it's not the easiest thing for a lot of people to do. And unfortunately, again, patience is one of those things that some people just want the result. I want the plant. You know, they don't understand the fact that it puts down these prop roots. It you know has to do that to be a healthy plant. How long would you say it takes to establish a root system, if you had to generalize?
A root system. Oh, that's cool. So
in your experience, anyway.
In my experience, I would say really it would have to be about a year, I would say, to get a really good root system. Not the little spindly sort of fibrous roots that you'll see initially. A lot of times you'll see like if you've ever grown a plant in, say, like a container of water.
Right.
Like an aeroid or something like that, you get those like filter roots. You'll start to see some of those initially as the tree is sort of reaching out and finding you know where it needs to go to insert those roots into the substrate layer. But to be honest, I would say probably about a year. I would have to say to get a really good base root structure, a year. You can kind of instigate a little bit of increased growth if you use flow around it. So like I actually have a couple wave makers that are directly behind some of my big mangroves, and I did it on purpose. One, because I like the way it looks with the peninsula tank, but two, the added waves constantly is hitting that acrylic rod with the mangrove on it, and it's kind of causing it the same sort of process that you would see in the wild. It's initiating that, I'm moving too much. I need to place down roots and be able to sort of steady myself so I don't just float out to sea or disappear somewhere.
Right.
And so by really hitting it with that flow, you can get some solid size prop roots pretty quickly. I mean, we're talking like finger size prop roots fairly quickly.
So you're saying flow from like a pump, either a pump return or like a vortex or something like that.
Yep. Well, yeah, I mean, or if your canister filter is pushing out enough flow, even directing a canister filter output directly near or at that mangrove that's on the clear acrylic rod.
Right. But just a great, great suggestion. Really great suggestions, because I think part of the fascination that people like is it's the whole thing. They like seeing the branches and the leaves, but they also like seeing the roots. And I think people don't give it a chance to establish. The other thing that I love about mangroves is I like when the leaves drop. I mean, you don't want leaves dropping in a lot, but I like in quantity. But when they drop into the water and fall to the substrate, because that sort of nourishes an ecosystem. You want to talk more about that? What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So in certain systems, I allow the leaves to sort of drop into the water column. In my one system that I'm sort of instigating or sort of mimicking, like the Indonesia region, I let the leaves drop in there because to me, it actually fuels the macroalgae that's down below. So of course, like this tree has taken up all this nutrients and some of them are actually bound up in that dead leaf. And so when it falls into the water, especially in the wild, it's essentially creating like a fertilizer or the next layer of substrate. It's like an ever existing cycle. It's returning back into the substrate that the mangrove itself is going to use to grow and continue to grow up. So certain systems I do it, certain systems I don't. It really depends on the specific outcome that I would like for that system.
No, there's one thing that you prodded me on. It was scary for me. Is my beloved little mangrove propagules that I had for like 2 years. You're like, it's time to trim them, Scott. Cut them down.
Gotta cut them.
It was a leap of faith. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to listen to Tyler. And I did. And it makes a branchier, nicer looking little tree. Can you talk, maybe give some tips on trimming your mangroves, like when to do it and the rationale behind it and technique?
Sure. Yeah, so I treat my mangrove trees kind of like you would treat a bonsai tree. So as mangroves are growing, you'll see that they kind of alternate their leaves. And so you'll have a pair and then they'll flip 90 degrees and you'll have a pair the other 90 degrees. And so what I do is really, to be honest, when a young mangrove propagule is growing, it typically grows straight up. It's going to keep growing straight up because in the wild, the one thing that it's doing is competing for light. And typically, it is not the tallest tree around. And so it's trying to grow as far up as possible. In your home aquarium, that's really not an option. Like that, there's no issue whatsoever. It's probably the tallest thing that you have around there. So when I look at it as about the 6 month mark, if I start seeing good root growth and I start seeing, say, that the tree is actually sort of putting out the leaves consistently, right? I know we talked about roots earlier. I like to not cut my trees, the tops of the trees, until the roots are really firmly planted into the substrate. Because what we're doing by chopping the leaves up top, we're actually starting to create a canopy. And if that root layer is not, really well established, your tree is going to fall over. You're just going to have a lot of issues as it's starting to grow outward. So as for the technique that I use, every new branch or pair of leaves actually comes from just above a leaf that's growing. And so if you want to grow branches, you can chop just above a pair of leaves and you'll get two branches growing in the same direction that pair of leaves is below it. And so you can do that by alternating, which direction you would like the branches to grow, or you can then take some, I think it's copper wire, or I might use aluminum. It might be like copper colored aluminum wire. And I'll actually wire the branches like you would a bonsai tree. I know there's like great tutorials out there on how to actually wire bonsai branches. I am not an expert in that sense. I have actually broken mangrove branches
Yeah,
before,
that's
so I'll
gutsy.
say use caution with it. But that allows me to sort of create this canopy. So I actually have a tree that I started. It was the first tree that a mangrove tree that I put in here. It's about 3 years old and it has every bit of, I would say, looks like 12, maybe 12 branches. And it's consistently growing out. And what I've been doing is just every time branch sort of extends out and gets, three or four pairs of leaves, I'll just start cutting that end node off. And then from there, I'll get two more branches that keep branching out.
What a
And that's
great
really how
tip.
you create that dense canopy.
Yeah, what a great
Otherwise,
tip.
you'll just get one giant spindly tree going straight up, which is why I told you had to cut
Right.
yours.
I waited too long. See, that's a funny thing because I've always been like, I love them so much. I was so afraid to cut them. I was like, I do not want. It was almost too late because I had these ridiculously long woody kind of like main trunk and very few branches. And it was like only when I started cutting them, thank God it wasn't too late. They started, branching out, like you said. But it's that leap of faith you have to take. You work so hard to get it to go, and you're thinking, ah, do I, am I going to hurt it? It's just like cutting a garden, any tree in the garden or cutting a coral or whatever. You don't want to necessarily do it at first, and then you do it and you realize, oh, this is beneficial.
Yeah, I so to kind of go onto that, it's definitely a leap of faith. So there was an individual that I met on Instagram. He grew mangroves. They were incredible. But he sort of waited too long, right? And so he reached out to me and he goes, what can I do? And I said, to be honest, if I were you, how's your root growth looking? And he said, root growth looks great. I said, start over. Chop them all the way back. Cut them back and start over. And so he was like, are you sure? And I was like, one of my mangroves, my cat literally ate it, like ate the mangrove, right? Literally just back to the tree. And I was like, man, this thing's gone. Like it's a goner. And about 6 months later, it grew back. I mean, now it has massive branches. It actually grew in a pretty, really weird way. But going back to that individual, initially he cut them back. It looked like they sort of died back. And I felt terrible. I was like, oh my gosh, I just gave this guy advice to cut his trees. And now they're dead, right? And so I felt bad. I sent him some more propagules. I'm like, I'm so sorry. Here you go. Here's some new ones to start fresh. I said, but on one condition, do not take those out. I want you to wait like another month and let's just see what happens. And so he got the new mangroves in. He tied them actually to the original mangroves that he cut back in there. And about a week ago, he sent me a picture and he goes, I will be damned. There's literally leaves coming out of these mangroves that he thought were dead.
That's like cool.
They're growing back. And it just shows that nature is incredible.
It is resilient.
How it survives. Yeah,
it is. And I have to tell you, I did it to one based on your advice. I cut it all the way down to the growth. I don't know. You even call it the growth tip or whatever. And it grew back. Yeah, it took a while. It looked weird, but it had it like you had indicated to this person. You asked me the same question. Does it have a healthy root system? I said, yep. You said, cut it. And yeah, it works. So that's the beauty of mangroves. I don't know what it is. I mean, you probably feel the same. I feel emotionally attached to the mangroves, like I would a fish or an animal. There's something very, I don't know.
These are my children.
They're kids. Yeah, it's weird how I feel about those plants. Yeah.
To be honest, I think I'd be more devastated if something happens to my mangroves than something else that happens in my tank. I mean, as much as I want to, like, you know, I, of course, care for my animals and everything in my tank for animals, because corals are considered animals. But
you can always get another fish. Yeah.
The mangroves, to me, it's an investment of time.
Yes.
And so you put so much into them and you want them to succeed just as much. So I get your restriction when I told you to cut it. I understand.
I was it was emotional. It was like, you know, it's cutting your kid's hair or something. You know, it was rough, but it works. You know, and you hit it on the head. Mangroves are this like investment of time and energy and love and passion. And because it takes a lot, I mean, it takes time for them to establish. When they finally get established, it's super satisfying. I think more than almost anything I've ever kept, more than any other aquarium plant or even more than like almost any coral I've ever kept, the mangroves just have always, there's something very satisfying about them. When you see it blossom into a tree, it's just a cool, cool thing.
So I think a lot of people's misconceptions, they see the trees that I have, pictures of them, and they're like, you know, how do I get that? Well, wait about 10 years.
Yeah.
And it takes a long you'll have time. Something like this. I mean, I have mangroves here that are every bit of 10 years old. I have some that are going on 4, maybe 5 years. I have some that are, you know, a couple years old. I mean, really, to be honest, when you get that mangrove propagule, that tree's already about a year old when you get it. And so for me, it's a labor of time, a labor of love to really let that, you know, that tree grow. And to be honest, the pinnacle moment I think I've had by keeping these is I actually have prop roots. I have a prop root that is every bit of about 3 foot long.
That's awesome.
It is the most impressive thing.
That is so cool.
And now it's actually, I have a rock at the front of my peninsula style tank. And this prop root has finally hit this rock. And it's actually, because it's hit it, it's now forking out and pushing this prop root up. Like, that's I'm pretty awesome. Sure in the next year, this prop root will be out of the top of the tank.
That's super cool.
Which is the coolest thing ever.
Cool.
I mean,
yeah,
it's exactly what everyone
you see
wants.
In one. Yeah, it's so cool. And, you know, the other thing too is these propagules are tough. I think people have to realize my favorite story about one of the first mangroves I've ever had, I'm name dropping, but it's a true story. I was down visiting Tony Vargas and Julian Sprung, and Julian and Tony said, like, they in Florida. And I said, let's go collect near, we went to Key Biscayne Bay, right up near Miami, near Julian's, not far from Julian's house. Let's go play in the mangroves, we'll collect some stuff, whatever. You're allowed to collect the loose propagules. You can't collect the plants, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I remember we grabbed a few. It was just more fun just walking around while the tide was going out and just checking out all the life among the roots. And I grabbed one. I was wearing my like board shorts and I stuck it in the back pocket. One of these little propagule that I thought was really cool. I'm like, this is a tiny one. I forgot I had it. And I remember I flew home a few days later. A few weeks later, I finally got around to washing my board shorts. I'm like, oh crap. And I open them up. I'm like, oh, there's something in them. I'm like, oh crap. I had that propagule was in there. So it sat in a dark pocket for about 3 weeks. And I'm like, oh, is it going to die? It wasn't shriveled up or anything. I'm like, put it in water, you know, secured it. And lo and behold, it sprouted. And I still have this plant.
Oh my gosh, that's incredible.
It's my oldest one. I still have it. Yeah. It's been with me in two different houses that I've owned. it's been around, and I still have it, and it's kind of cool. They are remarkably resilient. I mean, in propagule form particularly, but the plant can be tough and challenging. But boy, there's something about them, you know.
Yeah, and I'll say, so I have a little trick that I do, especially if you're placing a propagule in salt water. If you get in a propagule with some roots and they're broken when you bring them in, my favorite tool actually is just cut that root off and super glue the end, right? You're essentially capping off the root, all right? And that allows the mangrove, the red mangrove, to be able to continue its sort of pressure system if you're placing it into a saltwater system. So I've done it in the past. I've actually broken my giant prop root and immediately freaked out.
Oh, I'd be devastated, yeah.
And went and grabbed some super glue and just simple old super glued it. And, it'll cover over the
injury root.
You know, of course, yeah, it'll grow over like you would any other tree would. It'll grow over that, you know, that wound and continue to grow and thrive. But that's definitely my tip. If anyone is getting any mangroves in the mail and they see that the roots are broken prior to putting it into a saltwater system, definitely check your roots and use some super glue to cap off any broken roots.
I actually think it based on my experience and now hearing yours, I think it's easier. I'm always happy when I get propagules that don't have any roots, because
I agree.
You don't want to damage those roots, and people, their natural tendency is to shove it into the substrate. And it's like, that's how you damage it. Instead of just lashing it to an acrylic rod or something like you suggest and let it find the substrate, the inclination is to push them in and you damage the root and you can kill the plant. And it's, I'm always trying to find propagules with no roots or very minimal roots. I think that's a better way to go. And I wanted to, we spent a lot of time talking about mangroves, which is like the big focus, but your aquarium is kind of cool because you have mangroves and then you have macroalgae in it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is another area where I think people coming over from freshwater would have a lot of fun, because many of these people already have the talent to grow aquarium plants. Saltwater tanks, marine algae aren't that much different. I know seagrasses I've talked about before. A little bit different, but tell me a little bit about your thoughts on macroalgae and kind of what's going on in the world of macroalgae, marine macroalgae in aquariums.
Yeah, no, I think, to be honest, macroalgae to me reminds me more like a freshwater plant. I know that they're not, but
right.
They remind me in the same sort of care requirements that I would be if I was trying to keep any type of like planted tank, whether it's a low tech or a high tech. There's different macroalgae that require lower light, higher light, different types of trace elements or specific types of major or minor elements, very similar to how you would dose like fertilizer or, you know, iron or things like that, you know, in a freshwater tank.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the great benefits I saw, was not only can I bring sort of the concepts that I've understood for many years of freshwater tank, but I can utilize these macroalgae as sort of a natural filter, right? So we kind of go back to what I was saying with my fishbowl per se.
Yep.
The macroalgae itself is sort of the way that I can keep fish in there, and they can, you know, when they, you know, eat food and dispose of the waste or whatever, then the macroalgae utilizes the nutrients from that, and you can kind of keep that cycle going. So it allows me to not have to worry too much about the nutrient, uptake, or needing to have, say, like a skimmer or something to export that nutrient.
Right,
all
right.
I have to do is I can go in
there, harvest the macro,
trim some of the macroalgae, and then there you go. Essentially exported the nutrients that were building up in the aquarium.
Exactly. It's like the so-called algae reactors that are all the rage right now, which I laugh at that. I mean, I get the idea, but I'm thinking, gosh, if more people would just do a macroalgae tank, well, that's a refugium basically to a lot of people. You know, that's the idea of having a separate aquarium to culture this stuff. But macroalgae are excellent nutrient export mechanisms, and that's what's so cool.
Yeah, they really are. And I will say there's definitely specific ones that are better than others.
Oh, sure.
So you have to look at, is your goal of the macroalgae to export, or is the goal of the macroalgae to be a part of the overall aesthetic of the actual tank itself? Yeah. I mean, of course, ultimately they all utilize them. Some just utilize more or take up more nutrients quicker than others.
Right. And some are calcareous, like, for example, like not the Caulerpa. I'm thinking of
Halimeda.
Halimeda, yes, of course. Yep. Like Halimeda, calcareous macroalgae. They'll take your alkaline, your calcium, right, suck it right up, and they'll compete against corals. Do you have a good growth?
Yep, I just started dosing kalkwasser to actually keep up with it, because when I left for a work trip, I thought I had my dosing set up properly. I'm using Alpha Reef, which is like
calcium formate. Yeah,
calcium formate. Yep. And so I was like, this should be good. And then when I got back, my alkalinity had dropped from 8.5 to about 4.2.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's so a lot of demand there.
Yeah. Over about a week and a half time period, I essentially had gone through that much alkalinity buffer. But you can tell. I mean, the Halimeda is just growing
it
like crazy.
Sucks it up. Yeah. It's an amazing macroalgae too. To me, that's one of my favorites, because it's like a little independent little plant. That's what I love about it. It has those little roots and a very interesting one. Let's talk about dosing too, because since we're on the subject of dosing and feeding, a lot of freshwater people can relate to this. And those of us in the reef world, we are lately, a lot of us use dosing pumps because it just makes the job easier for dosing major and minor trace elements. But you're talking about, in this case, calcium, for reasons that you've already made clear. What other things are you dosing? And, how did you get that dialed in? And what dosing system are you using?
Oh, gosh. All right. So I have a couple dosing systems. Originally, I started off with the Camor, just the single head dosers. And so as I sort of added more items onto my dosing regimen, I would just add more single heads. You can kind of daisy chain them together.
Right.
Currently now, because I have a controller, I'm using the GHL doser because it's paired up with my aquarium controller. So I'm able to be able to see dosings happening while I'm away, adjust dosing if necessary while I'm not at the at home. But for what I'm actually dosing myself, one of the key ones that I'm using is actually Easy Boosters phytoplankton. I can set it up on a dosing pump. I can dose it at daytime and nighttime, so that way I can hit all the different types of filter feeders or corals that eat at different times of the day. I think phytoplankton is a very beneficial sort of additive to any type of reef tank. And then for the macroalgae themselves, I'm dosing Brightwell's Neonitro, the Neophos, not so much in the Neophos, that depends on how the levels are at. Mostly Neonitro. A lot of times nitrates are taken out of the system pretty quickly, especially on
with plants,
specific type of plant or macroalgae. And then Chato Grow, which is a sort of fertilizer. You can think of it like your typical fertilizer.
Iron based or?
Yeah. It's actually, it has iron in it, but it's not much. It's like if I remember correctly on the bottle, it only has like 0.1% per the dosing.
Minor.
It's mostly like other ones like manganese, potassium, things like that. And then I'll dose Ferion, which is like the chelated iron, I believe it's chelated.
Oh, gotcha. How did you determine your dosing regimen? I mean, do you do it by testing, or did you just kind of like use manufacturer's recommendation to start and then kind of look at the growth of
mostly I looked at the manufacturing sort of recommendation, but then I trust the manufacturer's recommendation, and then I go about half of what they recommend.
because they're trying to sell products and you're trying to grow a plant without having an algae bloom, right?
Yes. Yeah. So I look at what the manufacturer says and I divide that by two, and then I go, okay, let's start with that. And then I do have dosing or like testing kits for that. I don't think anyone should be dosing anything without testing.
Yes.
I think to be able to dial it in properly,
you got to know what
you should be testing. Yeah, you should be testing to make sure, because a lot of these are super concentrated. And so you can really overdo it really quickly.
And this is nothing new that freshwater plant people, don't know. I mean, again, they're high-tech so-called high-tech planted tank. That's every bit as complicated as a reef tank. I'm just surprised that automated
dosing. Sometimes it's more complicated.
It is. I'm surprised that automated dosing systems like we use in the reef side are not popular with the freshwater people yet, or they're just starting to be.
I think they are. I definitely finally started seeing more high-end plants. I do follow quite a bit of freshwater aquascapers.
And they're starting to use them now? Because
they are starting to use them. Yeah, I definitely say it. I wish that when I was doing freshwater planted tanks, the dosing pumps were more readily available. It would allow me to step away from a tank, right? My whole thought with setting up an aquarium, it really shouldn't take over my life, right?
Exactly.
I want to enjoy it. So if there's any way that I have the funds to sort of automate anything, I'm going to automate it so that way I can minimize the amount of actual work that I have to do.
Yeah. You're not a slave to the tank. And you do those things to maximize your enjoyment of the tank and ability to get away from it if you need to. I think that's a distinction.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's really what I hope the future brings for the freshwater folks. It allows them to sort of create these incredible tanks, but not have to put all that labor into it
because it's a lot.
Enjoy them more. It is
that estimative index stuff. It's like that's a lot. I mean, that's harder than any reef tank dosing that I've ever done. I mean, it's impressive what they do. But I think some of these dosers. I use the Red Sea Reef Dose, which I love it. It's so easy.
It's a good doser.
It's a really good doser. It's very reliable, very accurate. It's app based, so I like it. And it's made, you know, dosing two part and magnesium easy in the reef tank. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with just, you don't have to have a doser. I mean, I don't want to scare people away from stuff by saying you have to have all this tech. You know, I think, you know, you were saying you're doing this because it makes your life easier when you travel or whatever. The precision is nice. And, you know, what other equipment do you use? Now, do you use a protein skimmer or?
No.
Okay, good. There's no need, really, for a tank like yours. It's not necessary.
For the size of tank, a water change will really do anything that needs
to be. Resets. Yeah.
Yep. So for me, in my fishbowl tank with a big giant mangroves, I did initially start off with a canister filter. It ironically flooded my apartment and actually the apartment below me.
Oh, no.
So that kind of nixed that one. So I actually pulled the canister filter off it and then saw that the tank was progressing well without it. So I was like, well, there's no need for it. So the only thing that's in there is two MP10s, which are essentially just wave makers, and then a heater. There's two MP10s. Now I have an additional Jabo that I'm using for a wave function because I love seeing the Gorgonians wave back.
Yeah, and the current. Yeah.
Yep. Nice. And then a heater. And that's it. That's all it is. The biological filtration is in the rock and the corals. The chemical now is part of the, hang on back with a little bit of carbon in there. And mechanical, I don't really do anything for mechanical. For me, I think anything related to mechanical, I'll either siphon out when it comes to the water change, or it'll just be reused for, say, fertilizer for the mangroves or any of the macroalgae that are in there.
Yeah, it's such a refreshing approach. I was going to ask you in terms of maintenance, because I know people are going to ask, what would you say, what is your typical maintenance routine on a, I don't know, weekly, monthly, daily basis? What do you do?
So I'd say daily, I usually come home and I'll scrape the glass. So I tend to run a little bit higher nitrate. So I will get a little bit of that algae film growing on the glass. That light green. Yeah. So I just usually scrape that away. Every 2 weeks I do a water change of 5 gallons. So nothing too crazy.
Nope.
And then really, to be honest, that's about it. So that's my maintenance,
but that's beautiful. And then again, that's the beauty of an ecologically diverse aquarium, reef, freshwater, whatever. Your maintenance is actually pretty easy because the organisms within the aquarium are utilizing a lot of the things that you're trying to export by other means. So doing a water change is probably one of the best and simplest things you can do. And you have a tank filled with coral too. So, you know, wow.
And I'll caveat this. Don't have a heavily stocked fish population. I think a lot of people go into this, especially from the freshwater side, and they see that, you know, they can put in a bunch of tetras, right? Put in a massive amount of tetras. In my saltwater tanks, I think that tank has 4 fish in there, paraclowns, a goby, and then a geometric pygmy hawkfish. That's it. There's 4 fish in there.
That's it.
And to me, that allows me to sort of maintain that sort of regulation of just doing every 2 week water changes.
Right.
Now in my other system, which I've sort of nicknamed the Driftwood system, which I would like to get into actually, because I think your users would love that.
Yeah.
I do have more fish in there, but it does have a sump. And so I can, it has a little bit larger of a water volume. So it allows me to sort of do a little bit more fish, but yeah. So that system is actually my sort of play towards utilizing freshwater aquascaping materials in a saltwater setup.
Nice.
I have been sort of, it's been an idea in the back of my head for sort of years, right? You know, we try to emulate these great prop roots from mangroves, but it takes years for that to come around.
Right.
And my thought was, I saw this pine manzanita wood at one of my fish stores, and I was like, you know what? Let's try this out. So I created this little pine manzanita like root structure, some zip ties, very much similarly using a lot of the techniques you use as a freshwater, some super glue and, you know, little wads of filter floss to sort of bind them together, some zip ties that you can kind of tuck and hide away. And I planted that into my saltwater system. And from there, I'm utilizing mangrove propagules. Instead of attaching them to the clear acrylic rods, I'm actually just tucking them into little sections of this root structure, this pine manzanita root structure. And the whole concept is, in the wild, you have hurricanes. Hurricanes knock over big giant trees, and this is the new growth that's coming.
Yep.
So it's essentially created this entire little ecosystem around this little root cluster. And right now in there, I have a little group of just silver, I think they're like shortfin mollies. But it's really cool to see this group of like six or seven fish just shoaling around.
That's cool.
These roots.
That's super cool.
They're not like super colorful fish, but it's something you find it from the freshwater side.
Exactly. And did you ever see my brackish water tank that I had a few years ago where I did something very similar? I had mangrove roots.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's where I got the idea from.
And it was one of my favorite tanks I've ever done. It's the same thing, mixing the living elements with the root. It kind of breaks my heart because I had a chance. What happened was I was able to get mangrove branches from a guy that was, he reached out to me, this is years ago, in Honolulu, where in Hawaii, the mangroves are invasive. They're considered a pest. So the city of Honolulu was cutting these things down because they're invading the natural waterways. I mean, that breaks your heart to think about it, but they were cutting them down and they were just burning the wood or offering it for firewood or whatever. And so he was collecting it and he's like, hey, maybe you'd be interested in this really cool looking stuff. And I bought as much as I could at the time. And he had a little cottage industry. As soon as they were cutting it down, he'd go collect it and send them out to me. Unfortunately, they're not doing that program anymore. I think they've successfully eradicated the bulk of what they wanted. But we were able to get a very substantial amount of this mangrove wood, which is basically pretty much gone now. And we were able to create these kind of tanks. And I wish I had access to that again, because I love your idea of sort of creating a little version of that. And that would be a good entree to brackish or, in your case, you know, marine.
Yeah, it's a full saltwater tank. I mean,
yeah, I love that.
With a lot of driftwood. And I think for a beginner hobbyist, I don't know if I would recommend that so much, because there is a lot of aspects to it. Yeah. So that's partly why I'm dosing a kelk washer. It's to help raise that pH. So that way the pH from the acidifying driftwood, as the tannins do leach into the water column, not a ton, but they, you know, they do over time as it breaks down, doesn't cause too much of an issue with the corals and coral skeleton and even the halimeda, which is the, you know, calcium-based macroalgae in its growth patterns. And so between both using kalkwasser to raise the pH to get it above, you know, to a typical reef tank level, which is, you know, around your 8.2, 8.3 range, I'm also using carbon. So actively removing that tannic acid, that yellowing of the water through just carbon. And getting that out. And right now, so far, it's been successfully growing quite a few corals. And the only thing that I'm consistently running into is a little bit of hair algae. But with anything with high nutrients, you're going to have excess sort of nutrients in the water where things are going to take hold of it and use it.
I think that that's an important point. And I think also, oh, I just wanted to mention for those, because some people will probably ask that aren't familiar with it. Kalkwasser, it's a German word, basically means lime water or calcium hydroxide. It's a saturated solution of calcium hydroxide. And we use that a lot in, or it used to be much more popular, but it's sort of becoming popular again for raising the pH in reef keeping. So it's something you hear a lot, and it's a simple and really fun way of doing it too. You really get to work with your tank. Or you, do you drip it in, or do you add it manually?
I drip it. Yeah. I have it set up on a doser. I drip it at night so far. Actually, I just recently started it. So it's been like the last 3 days I've been sort of monitoring, testing, and then tweaking the amount of dosing that I'm doing over the 12-hour night period when the lights are off.
Yeah. Yeah. I would imagine that keeps you busy. Speaking of corals and dosing, do you maintain like gorgonians and soft corals in this tank? What are ones that you keep or recommend for somebody wanting to foray into this kind of little ecosystem that you created? What would you recommend?
Ooh, so I think if you're going to emulate the sort of no filter tank and you're kind of going after the Caribbean, I would definitely say a lot of gorgonians. I think you can find various photosynthetic, meaning that they don't have to worry about being fed constantly. You'll see in the reef hobby that there is non-photosynthetic corals typically found at deeper depths, but we have photosynthetic gorgonians that you can just grow by light, and you can get a lot of different variations of them. I think that's a really cool aspect of it.
Yeah.
I think an underappreciated coral in the hobby.
For sure.
And then for my Indonesian sort of inspired one with the driftwood, I've been keeping a lot of cinularias, so like finger leathers. I have the Cercophyton elegans. I actually have,
how big is that tank? I'm sorry to interrupt. The
42 one. It's the same type.
Okay.
Literally the same exact tank, except for this one I was smart enough to put a sump on it to at least move a lot of the equipment down below.
So you don't have it. Yeah, you need the room for those cinularia get big. Yeah.
They do get big. So yeah. I do have three different variations of cinularia, two that actually are pulsing, which is kind of cool.
Oh, yeah. You don't see that very often. Yeah.
And then there's this other coral that I haven't really identified yet, but I think I've seen it online as gone as like asparagus coral. It's like not super common. I've seen it in some dive photos.
It almost looks like a gorgonian sort of, right? No.
It's almost kind of like not like the Koji Wade Nephthias. They almost look like Nephthias.
Right.
But it's almost like this lightish pink sort of brown color. And they do have the sclerites that...
Interesting. So it is the coral.
Coral. But it's weird. I'll have to send you a picture.
Yeah, I want to see that. It's really interesting.
It's a strange one that I picked up. And I think it reminds me of this... It's hardy, yeah. There's no like hard skeleton the inside. It's just like if you look at it, you'd be like, oh, it kind of looks like a Nephthia, but not really. So I've seen a couple photos that I think look like it from dive photos in Indonesia, and they were kind of being called as like asparagus coral, which doesn't really help anything.
No, that's like, yeah.
So I'm still trying to sort of ID this one. I do have a good friend who's an incredible ID artist.
That's important.
In California. Yeah, he works for the Aquarium of the Pacific. So he actually maintains, their big, giant, massive, like 30-year-old reef tank. So I usually send him a bunch of pictures if I
have what is this? Issues. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, that's cool. So again, combination of soft corals, gorgonians, mangroves. It's pretty formidable. That's a pretty cool thing. Do you have any like polyp type corals, like like yellow polyps or green star polyps or clove polyps or anything like that?
So I have some blue suspicularia.
Suspicularia.
It's
Eflotinaria.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then I have like a they call it Anthelia, waving hand
Anthelia. I love Anthelia. That's one of my favorite soft corals.
So that's like another really easy coral. And then I guess I have a yellow branching parietes that I'm growing.
That's cool.
I think
that's
an ORA one. That's the only like real stony coral that I have.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a really cool Just giving essentially as much alkalinity and calcium that the Halimeda doesn't take up goes to
it's grabbing what it can.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I tend to stay away from a lot of the stony corals. Not in the sense of like, I can't keep them. It's more of the factor of like, they need a little bit more added care. For me, with being able to travel and not have to really worry about my tanks when I'm gone, soft corals for me is the easiest way to go about it. They're very hardy. They mm-hmm. can, they don't have to worry about little ebbs and flows and you know, the overall chemistry. But so I typically stay to that. But I think my pride and joy stony coral that I have is Blue Ridge coral.
Oh, Heliopora. Wow.
Yes, Heliopora.
You don't see those too much anymore. You don't see
no, you don't.
Those. That's a cool coral.
Yep. So that's been my little pride and joy. I have been growing that one for the last year, and it is a slow grower, I'll tell you that.
Oh, it's really slow. And, you know, is yours the one that's like tan on the outside and then it's, or does it actually have blue? Because usually the Blue Ridge coral, it's when you break a piece off, it's blue inside and tan on the outside. Is yours actually blue?
Mine's almost like a purplish color.
Oh,
it's
wow.
Like a purplish color with like a little bit of like, I think the polyps are like kind of purple. But yeah, if you break it open, you'll definitely see the blue on the inside.
Yeah, it's an interesting coral. That's cool. So what's your favorite of your macroalgae that you keep? I'm bouncing Ooh. Around, I know, but if you had to choose.
No, you're good. One. So, oh gosh, that is hard. I'll actually go with not a macroalgae, but a seagrass.
Tell me Thalassia or Halodule.
Yes.
My favorites. You know, I love seagrass. I used to grow seagrass quite a bit. Like, I regret that I stopped doing that. And back in my uni corals days, we had a huge raceway and I had a little section where I grew seagrasses. And I went on a trip one day and the people that were taking care of that section made some boo-boos and they killed off my seagrasses and I was not happy. And I have not been able to get
start growing some more.
I would love to do that. I would love to propagate. I had it down. I was doing it in my house in the backyard. I had like one of those little plastic, you know, kettle troughs. I like a kettle trough. Yeah. One of those rubber made kettle troughs. And I had it down. I grew them in like little, I don't even know why I grew them that way. Just for the fun of it, because I had my own seagrass tank. But I grew it, Halodule and Thalassia, they're my two favorites. I tried paddlegrass, which is, I forgot what the scientific name of that stuff is. That wasn't as hardy, but yeah, I think seagrass would be so popular right now. I would love to get back into that, do a proper seagrass tank again. You would kill it. You would do so well with that. You would love it.
So I have a little bit of seagrass. I have a little bit and it's doing well.
Oh, cool.
But I definitely want to get some more variations. I have like trying to remember the scientific names of them. Turtle grass,
shoal grass. Yeah, Halodule, which is shoal grass, and turtle grass is Thalassia, and then there's one other, Syringodium, I think. I have a hookup, a friend that does go, he does have he's like a partner in a coral propagation importation firm down I can't really say what country because I guess he's kind of doing it.
Yeah.
He's still trying to establish his business before he starts going crazy with it. But he told me that he will do his best to try to get me some seagrass. And he's
got to get me that connection.
Yeah. And it's beautiful because he's got the permission of the government there to do it. And it's so they're just trying to build up a little system. And I said, we've got to bring in seagrass. So yeah, that's my goal within the year or so to try to bring in that. And you will definitely be on that short list of people that's going to get them, because getting seagrasses awesome. Into the hands of talented propagators would be the key. Just like with coral, you know, it just took a little while to get established. Seagrass is kind of the next frontier in marine plants. I mean, marine macroalgae is having such a moment right now with you and that Tiger Boy and Mitch, a few other people playing with it. It's neat to see. And there's that guy in Japan. Do you see him on Instagram? Ixtarium, I think is what he goes by. Yep. Is it Ixtarium? Ixtarium. That guy does some amazing little tanks. People check out this guy's account. Really cool little, almost like experimental little systems. It uses a lot of Calerpa, but it's just such a cool little looking aquariums that he does. Real ecologically diverse. It's fun. I think the stuff is getting fun again.
Yeah, I love his setups because I think he has a store of some sort, and I think he has collection rights over there in Japan. And so he goes out and he's able to collect and pretty much set up these like instant ecosystems, and they are just so cool.
Diverse.
To watch Yeah, watch them thrive and see the diversity of like macroalgae in a home aquarium that's literally coming literally from shore to his
yeah, door. He's just like digging. He has videos of him. He put one up a few days ago. He's like digging the sand up, plopping it in the bowl and taking the water, and he had some damselfish and some gobies. Yeah, it was really incredible.
Super cool. I think love that. Dennis Tiger Boy, as he's known on Instagram, mm-hmm. Dennis and I have been good friends, and we've talked mm-hmm. about this a while. To be honest, the way that we saw the macroalgae sort of expanding and really evolving in the saltwater aquarium side of the hobby was really actually getting the freshwater folks interested.
Yeah, that's the key.
Because
they know how to grow stuff.
Folks know how to grow this. They understand that aspect. And to them, that seems like an easier jump into the saltwater side than, say, setting up a full-fledged mixed
reef. I agree, but it's actually a really cutting edge to do this kind of stuff. Like what you're doing is actually a very exciting subspecialty, and probably every bit as challenging and fun as a reef tank, really, if not more so, more satisfying to me.
I look at it as we're experimenting, and so it's really cool to be able to push forth and experiment the same way that I'm experimenting with different types of hardscape. It's unknown.
It is unknown, and it's different, and it's nice to see it getting the attention it has. I remember being a big macroalgae fan for years, and it was just hard to get macroalgae, and there wasn't a lot of interest in them except for refugiums, for nutrient export. And it was kind of like one of those little, like, why do you want to get, halimenia and all these kind of interesting macroalgae that people were, Botrycladia, all that kind of stuff. And keep them, actually enjoy them for what they are. And they're actually quite pretty. I'm tooting my own horn and it sounds terrible, but like, I think it was 2009, 2010. I spoke at MACNA that year, and I did my talk was on macroalgae and seagrass. Mm-hmm. And it was cool because a lot of people were interested in it, but just nothing ever came of it. And I unfortunately wasn't in the industry side at that point where I was able to do anything with it. And then by the time I got to, my Unique Corals days, we were bringing in some macroalgae, but a lot of it was from propagators. So there was some lady in Minnesota that was growing it, and we would buy it from her. And we couldn't keep the stuff in stock. And this was back in 2013, 2012. So there is a market that it was always kind of an underground thing, just like seahorse people. They have their own world. The macroalgae people have their own world. But it's becoming a little more mainstream in the hobby, and it's really exciting to see that now. And thanks to you guys putting, really exciting images out there every day, people are getting really inspired. And I think you and Dennis have such different approaches too. Like, his is a more artistic kind of forward approach, at least the way I see it. And yours is a more natural ecosystem kind of approach.
Yeah, I can say that. I mean, it's cool.
Yeah, and I was going to say, it shows there's more than one way to enjoy this stuff. And again, they can both pull in the freshwater people, which obviously we have a huge audience for, because they have skills already in those areas. And this just is sort of bringing out what they know.
Yeah, no, I mean, they're really the people who are going to advance this side of the saltwater hobby. There's only so many people that I know, really, to be honest, I could probably count all of them on both my hands, who actually are that I know that are so passionate about macroalgae. But when it comes to seeing the freshwater folks, and I was just at Aquashella in Dallas, Texas. Mm-hmm. And, when you see folks that are setting up, macroalgae displays at these shows, it's so cool to be like, oh my gosh, this is actually evolving and expanding.
Yeah.
Where you're seeing this technique and this style show up at large events where mass amounts of people are able to see, learn, and become interested in this side of it. So
it's amazing. And you guys are doing a hell of a lot of work to get that out there. And, it's the same satisfaction I get with the botanical thing. It that became a thing. It's become an accepted technique because of the work of a lot of people playing with this stuff. And suddenly it's trickling into sort of the side of the mainstream of the freshwater hobby. It's just an approach. And it's very satisfying to see that. And it's a very exciting time in the hobby, both freshwater and, salltwater.
Between you and Melanie, I mean, like,
oh, Melanie,
you two,
smelling it.
You two have really piqued my interest in a botanical style setup. I think that would be my next setup. If I were to set up another tank, I think it would be a botanical style setup. I've just fallen in love with your guys' style and techniques and
it's the aesthetic just so different. Of
that you have. It is.
Yeah, and that's, it's very different. Well, that's what, again, that's the appeal of the macroalgae, the softies and the mangroves. It's that so different than what everybody is doing, yet it appeals to something inside of certain people. You know, there's that natural kind of vibe that people really like.
Yeah, no, it's exactly what I was going to say. I mean, it's different and I like different. I like trying to forge, you know, I like to go after and try different things that, you know, maybe a normal hobbyist wouldn't be interested in, or wouldn't even, you know, even think to try and take that leap of faith into putting driftwood into a saltwater tank. I mean, the minute I told like a very old school reefer that I had driftwood in my saltwater tank, he kind of looked at me very puzzled, as like,
why would you do that?
Freshwater?
It's like, why would you do that? But that's the beauty, is the crossing over of ideas and techniques. All this stuff is really starting to happen now. And it's because people are so bold and innovative, and because we can share ideas so quickly with social media, good and bad. Mm-hmm. I think it's in a really an incredible time. I mean, people like you that are doing stuff that was probably not seen as anything close to being, I don't want to use the word mainstream, but just it was so different. Now it's like, no, it's just an approach, and you're
a different avenue
for the same thing. And that's the beauty of the aquarium hobby. It's like really in a good place right now. If people are starting to look over the fence, you know, freshwater people looking at saltwater people looking at freshwater people looking at other freshwater ideas, et cetera. So it's neat to see. And people like you are on the kind of cutting edge. And I love that.
It's cool. It's a great time. I mean, to be honest, I will say a lot of my inspiration for the tanks that I set up come from dive photos, mm-hmm. and really, to be honest, freshwater tanks. I'm looking at them and how they sort of scape their tanks, how they use the hardscape, what sort of inert stones that I could use, you know, to create these different environments. You know, I've used lava stone before. I've used actually Hakai river stone. I've used Siru stone. I mean, I've tried a lot of these different sort of hardscapes, and I think it's really, to me, like, I get a lot of inspiration from the freshwater folks, and I hope that you know, things that I'm trying hopefully gives inspiration to them to come over to the saltwater side, because I know that jump that when I made from freshwater to saltwater, it was nerve-wracking. It's a very nerve-wracking thing when you hear people say, you know, hey, this is super hard, and you know, you got to be really dedicated to it. And I would say, yes, it is. You know, anything that you're trying that's brand new is always going to be difficult, no matter what, because you're starting from square one.
Exactly. So
there's techniques and concepts that you have learned over the many years of your freshwater hobby that can play an incredible role in saltwater size. And we see it, you know, day in and day out now with a lot of these great freshwater aquascapers that are creating incredible, incredible saltwater tanks.
Yeah.
Using their techniques, and it's awesome.
Yeah.
It's a great time to be a part of this hobby and see the evolution that's going on.
It is. And again, you're right in the thick of it. And I love that. Well, man, Tyler, we probably should wrap this up. I told you, 45 minutes. We're way past that now, and two or three tries of this, but getting it to work. And I appreciate everybody that stuck with us when we put this together. Hopefully we'll have all the three little interrupted segments together. If not, this last segment was awesome. And we'll do this again. Yes,
I'd love to talk to you more. Absolutely, do this again.
We'll definitely have more on this, because I think this is such a fun time to talk about this stuff. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your afternoon to hang out with me here and talk this stuff. And again, I think it's going to inspire a lot of people. It has inspired a lot of people. It inspires me. And just keep doing what you're doing, man. It's really great to see.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for having me. No, I appreciate it. Hopefully we can meet one day
at a
show in the near future. Hopefully that's on your agenda sometime.
It is.
Catch up, have a drink, and really dive into the weeds.
Absolutely. We certainly will. And we'll do this again. And again, everybody, thank you so much for listening with us. Tyler, thanks for having us. What's the best place for them to find you? Instagram, or are you on other forums, or
Yeah, Instagram is probably the best place to find me, at inland underscore reef. That's INLAND underscore REEF. And then in there, I also have a link in my bio that goes to a couple YouTube videos that actually do a really good job of walking through and breaking down my setups, actually throughout the years too. So I have a good friend who's helped me document a lot of the setups, the creation and sort of the evolution of my tanks. So if you're interested in that, those videos are also linked in my Instagram page as well.
Fantastic. Well, that is great. You guys, everybody out there, thanks again for listening in. Tyler, it was great talking to you. We'll do this again soon. And everybody, thank you so much for being part of this little podcast. We'll see you on the next episode of The Tint. That's a wrap.